G'day, I'm Pete Dillon. Let's chat. Let's Chat is a space where you and I get to talk to some really interesting people. Let's chat to Ultravox's Midura. With a career spanning 40 years, there isn't much that Midura has not done in music. You may know his name from bands like Thin Lizzy, Visage, or indeed Ultravox. You may have even be familiar with his incredible solo career. I'm delighted and thrilled that somebody who I admired so much as a child is now a guest of mine. Midura, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, mate. What a remarkable career you've had.
I know, been a lucky boy.
What do you put the longevity down to?
Oh, you know what? I'm not quite sure. I think an absolute passion for it. That hasn't diminished at all. I still strive to make hopefully interesting music. I still challenge myself. I think there's a perceived belief from the public side of things that an artist, a songwriter, tries to better what his contemporaries are doing, you know, and that's not true. You're not trying to write a better song than who your contemporaries are. You're trying to write a better song than who you are, and not the last song that you wrote. So as long as I have that kind of attitude, I will continue to follow this weird and wonderful path that I've been following.
But it's also about telling the stories of your life and what goes on around you. From what I understand from singers and songwriters that I've spoken to before, there is an inherently autobiographical sense to the way that you write.
Well, there is, because that's, and I think that probably comes with time. I think when you start writing songs, there's a, you know, certainly in my case, a lot of it was kind of experimental and fiction. You know, a view on life, an idea, and you take it off somewhere that hasn't really happened. But as you go through life, you start writing about experiences or worries or, you know, things that you've just read or, you know, things that spark off, you know, emotions. You know, and that's the source of your material. So yeah, real life kind of takes over.
I hate to keep saying this, but you've been around for some considerable years.
Thank you.
I want to go back to the 70s and 80s bands like The Slick and Thin Lizzy and Rich Kids and Visage. I think at one point you were singing with Thin Lizzy, Visage and Ultravox all at once. Is that correct?
Well, I was producing Visage, which was a collective of musicians, one of whom was the keyboard player in Ultravox. And during the recording of the Visage album, Ultravox kind of fell apart, came back from an American tour without the singer and guitarist, had been dropped by the record label and, you know, all of that. And I ended up joining Ultravox because I was passionate about what they were doing. I thought they were doing amazing things. And just as I was putting the finishing touches to the first Visage album, I had just joined Ultravox. I got the phone call from Thin Lizzy saying, can you come to America and help us finish out this tour? So I was never a permanent member of Thin Lizzy, but it enabled me to make enough money to buy some of the equipment I needed for Ultravox. So Ultravox was my baby, as it were.
And look, if we were to say the rest, as they say, is history, is kind of true, because it was after you joined Ultravox that they first saw, I guess, some real chart success.
Yeah, I can't really put myself down to that. I think there's something happens to a band if you move around the members or you change the dynamics within a band. Obviously, you know, ideas change. You know, I was learning as much as I was giving when I joined Ultravox, I was learning an awful lot from the other three guys, because they'd been using technology a lot in what they'd been doing for quite a few years. And this was all kind of new and experimental and something that I really wanted to get my teeth into. So I just think it was the dynamics. You change something, and sometimes it gets weaker and sometimes it gets stronger. And I think we were in the fortunate position that because our backs were against the wall, we didn't think we'd ever get signed again, for all the reasons that I said before, to drop by labels and stuff. It kind of, we had nothing to prove to anyone. We just kind of went off and tried to make an album of hopefully interesting music, experimental music. And fortunately for us, one of the songs that we wrote became a huge commercial success.
Which is, of course, Vienna.
Which was Vienna, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you look back at that time and sort of shake your head and go, that was just luck, it was just the right sound for an audience at the right time? Or was that a really considered decision?
No, Vienna could easily have slipped between the floorboards and never been seen or heard of again. It was the antithesis of what radio were playing at the time. It was long, it was an electronic ballad that speeds up, then it's got a viola solo in the middle, for God's sake. I mean, we couldn't have thought of anything more, uncommercial to do with this thing. So maybe it was the fact that it was just real and honest, and it wasn't contrived. It was what we did. It was just an album track, the record company at the time, the label, desperately wanted to edit it down because at the time radio would only play a 3-minute song. This was 4.5 minutes long.
Mm. And I guess there is a sense that nobody else had done anything like Vienna. And if we go back to that period of music where it was sort of the experimental stage of the late 70s and early 80s, where synth music started to dominate, and we saw huge growth, particularly in Britain, of bands like Depeche Mode and Spandau Ballet and Human League, who followed you. There was this sort of an incredibly experimental movement, and I think that must have been an extraordinary thing to be a part of.
Well, you've got to remember there was a technological revolution right about the same time that all of these bands that you just mentioned, Human League have been doing it for quite a while. There's a lot of bands coming out of Sheffield and the north of England that experimented with synthesizers. And it's because the technological revolution allowed that, and the music industry at the time allowed you to be experimental. It wasn't quite as tunnel visioned as it seems to be right now. The industry at the time had enough wherewithal, enough money to sign a multitude of different types of artists, and therefore they signed the oddities. They signed things that weren't obvious commercial entities, and let them grow and just give them the tools and let them get on with it. Also, the technological revolution meant that because the Japanese synth manufacturers had started making affordable instruments, it meant that you could have a synthesizer and a drum machine and a tape recorder in your bedroom, and you could make your own records. You didn't have to go cap in hand to record labels and ask for £1,000 a day to go and make an album. You could do it in your bedroom. So it lent itself for this experimental music that was going on.
My guest is international superstar Mijua. My guest is international superstar Mijua. He's had an incredible impact on music that came out of the late 70s and early 80s and continued through. I can't talk to you, Mij, without mentioning the collaboration with Bob Geldof in writing Do They Know It's Christmas for Band-Aid in 1984. Do you still sit back and go, God, we did something incredible then, and I know you're still a trustee of the charity. Is it still that sense of accomplishment, or do you look and despair at the state of that part of the world still?
Well, yeah, of course you despair at it, because it doesn't really go away. Africa's a huge, huge continent. What we found that, what we thought was was a kind of isolated incident, you know, the famine of Ethiopia in Ethiopia in 1984, was basically global warming. You know, the reason the famine happened was the rains didn't come. They couldn't depend on the rains coming on a regular basis, so therefore the crops failed. You know, you add that to the fact that it was a communist country at the time, and you know, the Western world didn't really know what was going on, not in general anyway. So it was a you know, a hideous combination of elements that happened. So, you know, the fact that we called Band-Aid. You know, which is a sticking plaster,
yeah.
An elastoplaster. I don't know what you guys call them here, but
Band-Aids.
You know, it covers. There you go. It covers a cut, but it doesn't fix a severed arm. So there was a reason for calling it that. So what we intended to do at the beginning was just raise £100,000 because that's what we thought was possible to raise. When nobody saw it turning into this huge thing, you know, this massive thing that it became. And sometimes you look back at what we did and you think, wow, that was quite amazing. And other times you think, God, we created a monster. You know, you know, something that was going to be a 6-month project is now 32 years, you know, on.
Mm. Midge, apart from your incredible solo career, where I was listening last night to a beautiful acoustic version you did of Vienna, and then, you know, tracks like If I Was, I wonder, and it's probably a really stupid question, and forgive me for asking it, but has there been a pinnacle, has there been a point where you've sort of sat and thought, I can dust off the keyboard now, put the guitar down and stop, because I've achieved more than I ever wanted to? Or is there that drive to still keep going and create more and still be sort of at the forefront of what happens musically?
Well, a lot of it's got to do with perception. You know, I think that, you know, the longer you're doing this, the more people will come up and say, oh, are you still doing this? Because I haven't seen you on my television, or I haven't heard you on the radio except for your old stuff. But that's due to decisions that were made, you know, 20 years ago, you know, back in at the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s, when dance music started kind of dominating everything. I made a conscious decision not to go down that route, although it was kind of expected of me to do so, because anyone who used technology back in the 80s was expected to go down that dance route. And anything, any period in my life or career, if you look at anything I've done, the song is king. Take away the production values, and there's a song there. And dance music was the antithesis of that. It was all about the BPM and the sounds and the grooves and all of that, samples and loops and things. And the song was almost redundant. So I chose not to go down that path. And if you do choose that, you've got to expect that you will, by not using the tools given to you, you've got to expect that you will not be as commercially successful as you have been. Saying that, I have absolutely no regrets in making that decision. I still continue to strive to make interesting music, and will continue to do so as long as my my health, my life, my passion is still there to do so. Because I know, because of the advent of the internet, that people around the world depend on pieces of music that myself and then artists like me have chosen to carry on making music. They depend on those things as soundtracks for their lives, just the same way as I did when I was a kid growing up listening to, you know, David Bowie or Roxy Music or whoever. I depended on their next piece of music because that got me through whatever I was going through at the time.
Midge Ure is my guest. Midge, you mentioned David Bowie, and it sort of leads me to a question that's probably not going to be pleasant to ask either, but as you're seeing contemporaries leave for the big studio in this, we saw so many people who were influential in the music industry leave us. Is it heartbreaking, or is it challenging to watch your peers die at such a young age, and does it, it's, I'm assuming it may like most of us, may question your mortality. But what's the feeling like for somebody who's worked with George Michael and David Bowie and the like? How's that feel?
Yeah, it's odd, but I think it's perfectly natural that it happens. I mean, in some instances, you know, George was particularly young, I think, you know, and some, it's a natural progression, you know. it's no surprise that in an industry as vicious and wild and rock and roll as the music industry will take its toll. Maybe it's just taken its toll over a longer period. So I think it's part of the natural cycle, as sad and hideous as it is. I mean, you do start to question your mortality. You know, you look at heroes, because that's what they were. I mean, David Bowie was a hero of mine, although I knew him and met him many times. You know, he was responsible for me, you know, getting into the right side of the industry, you know, striving for interesting music rather than striving for chart success. I do think it's an odd thing, but I think whether, no matter what industry you happen to be part of, because they're the music industry, because they were on the radar of people all around the world, it becomes headline news. You know, in any other walk of life, that's the age. I'm now 63. That's the age that your friends and family start kind of falling off the edge. And it's sad, but that's the way it kind of is.
Midge, it's been a delight to talk to you. This is, I guess, my final question for you. What's next? What else can Midge Ure do musically, and will you continue to do?
I read a great quote by David Bowie, and it was mentioned by his son, and the quote was, I'll paraphrase it, something to do with, when you achieve something in life and you feel comfortable with it, that's the time to move on and do something else. Do something that makes you less comfortable, because eventually you'll become comfortable with that, and then it's time to move on and do something else. Now, that's probably the best thing I've ever read, that you know, you've got to keep striving for whatever that thing is you're striving for. For me, it's a better song or a better piece of music or a more interesting way of saying something than I've done before. You know, I'm not competing with my peers. I'm competing with what I've done in the past. Saying that, the next project that I have lined up is a kind of cinematic orchestrated versions of Ultravox and solo material, which I'm kind of 90% finished. So that's what I'll be doing the moment I get back to the UK after my tour here of Australia, and after that New Zealand, straight back and finish that. So then I'll be in the studio doing some new stuff.
Midge, it's been an absolute delight, and I dare say an honour for me to speak to you today. It's somebody I've grown up with all of my life, as you've been there as a constant presence in my musical influence. So I'm completely indebted to you for taking the time to chat.
An absolute pleasure, Pete.